Hello and welcome to another episode of the Generosity Freak Show. I am Brady. I am your host. And I am lucky to have had the chance to chat with Sarah Welch, who is our guest today. She's the vice president at Ideas 42, a behavioral innovations and research lab that does, among many things, focus on charitable giving and sustainability. And that's really what we're talking to her today. So we go into some of the research around donor advised funds and loss aversion and goal setting. We talk about testing and randomized control trials and its role in philanthropy. We kind of meander in a nerdy chat in a bunch of different areas. But Sarah is brilliant. She, just in case you don't trust me, she's got 2 degrees from Yale and 1 from Harvard, and her wedding cake was just made of cheese. So take that for what it's worth. She's really smart and does a great job of articulating some of the research that they're doing and how it applies to individual organizations as well as philanthropy overall. So thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoy the podcast.
Welcome to the freak show, here we go. It's just another freak show, here we go. I said welcome to the freak show, here we go. It's just another freak show, here we go. Welcome to the freak show, here we go. It's just another freak show, here we go. Welcome to the freak show, here we go. It's just another freak show, here we go.
Hi, Sarah. Thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
All right. So we're going to talk about Ideas 42 and some of your very cool research around user behaviors and charitable giving. But can you just tell us a little bit more about Ideas 42 and really how it came to be?
Sure. So Ideas 42 is a nonprofit organization. We actually started as a research lab at Harvard. We were founded by some behavioral scientists who wanted to apply the techniques that they were seeing in behavioral economics and psychology to the real world to help people immediately, rather than just focusing on the academic side of things. And let's see, that was about 10, 12 years ago. We've spun out since then, and now we're our own entity. We have maybe about 100 people across multiple offices, and we work on all sorts of different projects, all related to applying insights from behavioral economics to solve difficult social problems.
Awesome. And that's really where kind of I came across some of your research, because one of the problems you're looking to solve is how can we help people be more generous kind of at a high level. So that's what I want to talk about today. And really some of the research that went into a study called Best of Intentions. Can you just highlight kind of like that study real quick before we dive in? Like, why did you want to do that study and kind of how did you go about doing it?
Yeah. So that work, there are, I guess, a couple different aspects to it. So the first gap that we saw, so a lot of behavioral science, what we see, one of the challenges that we're looking at is we see people, see human beings who want to achieve some action and they have a hard time following through. So that intention action gap is something we see a lot in our work. Mm. And often we find that understanding the sort of cognitive quirks of humans and the context that's interacting with them, that we can solve those problems, then we can help people follow through on those intentions. And so in this case, the sort of intention action gap that we see are both in terms of generosity. So we did a study that surveyed some people about what their expectations around how much money they should be giving to charity. And we found that on average, people thought the number was something about 6% of your income. Mm-hmm. But in reality, the number is closer to 3%, the average in the US. And so there's a gap there that if you multiply out and extrapolate, that's about $250 billion a year that we're missing out on from the giving perspective. And then the other gap that we see is also in how, in where that money goes. So how intentional and how informed and how effective donors feel they are with their money. So there's some research that found it's, you know, something like 85% of donors say that they care about the effectiveness of the charities that they support. But when you dig into it, the number that actually donate based on relative performance of charities is something like 3%. So there's this intent, this desire to donate to a place where your money will do good and do it effectively, but it's hard to actually get to that part.
Yeah. And the last one in particular is, you know, really complicated, because there's the whole element of like, well, how do you evaluate performance of nonprofits and how do you compare one nonprofit to another nonprofit, which is its own like massive issue. then how do you communicate that in the ways that a donor could actually understand, you know, without needing a PhD in economic development to understand why, you know, a certain type of water system is actually more productive than this type of water system, mm-hmm. right? And then there's the front end communication side of letting them understand. So there's even some, you know, some challenges before we even get to that point of how can they even choose in the first place, right? So there's some fundamental, you know, issues that we have to resolve before we can even understand how to best position it, which is why, you know, the research that you and others are doing is really, really important. So let's dive into some of the specific areas of research that you did in that study. One of the things that you look into is like donor advised funds in particular, both as kind of a mechanism, right, of you can give and then distribute to many nonprofits. So it's interesting, but also kind of, you know, the rise of the DAF is something that in the philanthropic world, everyone's kind of aware of. But why specifically did you look into donor advised funds and how did you go about doing that?
Yeah. So Brady, I think you just mentioned this. They are really interesting, right? So in theory, the mechanism is a great way to support this intentional and informed giving. So it lets you as a donor set aside money now or plan to set aside money in the future in a recurring way. So you get that feeling of donating to charity and that warm glow now, but then you can actually take the time in theory to think thoughtfully about where you want that money to go. But in reality, what we see is a lot of money stays in DAFs. And that's the sort of behavioral explanation there might be that it's hard to, again, to follow through on our intentions. So we know that humans put things off and it's easy to procrastinate, especially in the case of DAFs where there is no deadline really for you to donate out. Grant out. And so we were really interested and our DAF partners were really interested in understanding that problem a bit more. So understanding, yes, how do you increase contributions to DAFs, but also how do you encourage people to grant out those contributions?
So one of the things that I found is you kind of did some survey type data, right, to just better understand, like, why do people even do DAFs and, you know, is this really altruistic or is this really financial? What did you find there in terms of maybe some of what they said their desire was?
Right. So a lot of people, and I don't question this really, people do have altruistic reasons for setting up a DAF, right? So they really do intend to give that money to charity and one day they will, and they want to do good, right? So, again, I think the challenge comes down to this behavioral question and this thing that we know how humans act, which is that it's hard to follow through on that intention. It's also hard to follow through because the guidance really isn't there, as you mentioned, right? So understanding where the right charities are to donate to, that takes time and effort. And yeah, you need to be a PhD or a CPA to pull the tax form to really understand what's going on. So there's that opportunity there to help those DAF users get that guidance that they need and help them follow through on those intentions.
Yeah. I'll circle back to this at the end after we talk about some of the actual experiments that you did, but can you highlight one? I know there's one kind of at your end, what can we do to get people to maybe consider giving or dispersing more frequently? Can you share more about that experiment?
Yeah. So one of the more basic challenges here is that in charitable giving as a whole, as a donor, you don't really get a lot of feedback about where you donate and where your impact really is. And so in a small way, we wanted to get at that. So what we did in this experiment is we created a year-end email to reflect back to donors, where their money was going, how much money they, I think it was actually quite simple. It wasn't even where, it was how much money they had contributed and how much money they had granted out. And that, even just that small amount of information is valuable and is more feedback than many donors really truly get. And what we saw was, so we saw some interesting impacts. I think, well, so first what we saw in smaller donors, this information, this feedback, is just, again, just a year-end email, prompted them to grant out more, really worked in terms of increasing their activity. And so what we, you know, digging into that a little bit, what that probably means is that those smaller donors are really experiencing this feeling of not getting a lot of feedback, not really knowing where they stand, and so really benefited from that and acted. The other thing that we saw that was interesting is that receiving this feedback caused most givers to sort of rebalance their portfolio. So to realize, like, oh, if I've been granting out a lot, I'm going to put more contributions in, and then, you know, vice versa, if if I have been slower on the granting out in the contribution space, to increase my grants out. So it definitely resonated, right? So it was definitely demonstrating that there is a need, that there is, that this barrier does exist, that DAF users really don't have a sense of where they stand in terms of their altruistic goals.
Yeah. I think that's really interesting. So, the point you made earlier is, people have altruistic goals, but even some of the treatments when they log in, it's really very financial driven, right? Here's your assets. And it's because a lot of donor advised funds are managed by asset companies that exist to maximize wealth and assets, which is totally fine, but they don't necessarily exist to like maximize your impact in the world. So it's interesting that I mentioned earlier, I used to work for an online DAF company. And one of the things that they've started doing is partnering with financial institutions to say, great, you can house the DAF, or like we can kind of work with you on your clients and housing the DAF. But we have philanthropic brokers, basically, that will help them more strategically give it away. So you be an expert at finance. Cool. We'll help them give the money away, kind of like once it's in there. And I think that's a pretty interesting approach, whether it works or not. That concept of just, division of labor, just because you're expert here doesn't mean you should be an expert here, right. Can help. So I think that's interesting. But the reflecting on one's giving is, it's not unique to DAFs. Like that's something that we've seen in other charitable research, where if you actually ask people, how is it that you want to use your time? How is it that you want to use your money? And if they actually think about it, they're actually more generous with their time and with their money. It's just hard to get people to pause and think about, their time and money. So the DAF environment seems like a great environment to do that more frequently. Like, what are some of the applications of this type of concept, maybe within a DAF or just kind of for nonprofits or charitable giving writ large?
Right. Yeah. No, I mean, there's a couple of things you just touched on. So one is that is remembering that donors have such a limited attention. Everybody, right? This is true of everyone. Getting in front of someone to get them to sit and think about their giving is actually really hard. There's a lot of other things going on. You're competing with a lot of other things in their lives. And, I just want to go back to one of the interesting things about DAFs, right? Is that you've already dealt with one piece of that challenge is getting them to set aside that money. And so then that platform becomes very interesting in terms of an opportunity to get someone to think, sit down and think one more time about where that actually goes.
Right. Yeah. So it's kind of, you have to do it twice as opposed to, the once. That's interesting. I mean, the one experiment that we've ran with a nonprofit, for example, is for returning donors. And that's key, like returning and repeat donors in the online giving flow. There's a question that's just, what would you like to see your money do this year? Basically, right? So it's like a membership type renewal. And by asking that pause and think question for them, it helped increase giving. I think it was almost 50% for those people. But if you ask that type of question to a new user, it tanks because, they don't know you yet. They don't know what your impact is yet, right? So it's like where we ask the question and in what context is really important too. Like if you just ask an average person on the street, they maybe wouldn't react the same way a donor advised type, person would too. So I think that's what's interesting with these concepts is, it can be applied in two different areas and one will be really successful and one will be, not successful.
Right. And that gets the importance of testing.
There you go.
Care a lot about.
which we'll circle back to because that's obviously really, really key. So another interesting experiment that you did was, I'm maybe using the wrong terms because I'm not a behavioral economist like you, but like loss aversion or framing or something like that. Can you explain? It was in the context of workplace giving and just so many people don't max out their matches. Is that basically the problem?
Right.
Can you explain that one for us?
Yeah. So we did some work looking for ways to encourage. So it wasn't even, give the match is a piece of it. This was actually a free credit that you could just donate to a charity of your choice. Yes. So free money.
Free money.
We're leaving it on the table. And it was new employees specifically. And so this one, again, not to keep going over this, but attention is limited. So this really shows us too, because this is free money and new employees were being told about it. And the usage of the credit was something like 25% or even lower than that. Sorry, I think the baseline was much lower than that. What we did is we tried a couple of techniques to both get attention and then also motivate people to use that credit. And so The loss aversion piece, just to step back and explain that a little bit, is that as human beings, we feel the loss of an amount of money much more strongly than we feel the gain of that same amount. And if you can go online and go find some tests to run on yourself to really experience that. But basically what we wanted to do here is reframe that $25 credit as not a credit, but as like something that you have. And if you don't use it, you will lose, as opposed to this like bonus that you could give if you want. And so we reframed it as a loss. And then also in terms of making sure we were getting attention, we tried two different types of tone. I think the first one was more of a sort of corporate tone. And then the second was a more personal, warm tone. And that personal tone was much more effective at, I think, probably getting attention, really. And then, so we started with getting attention with that personal, warm tone. And then we had that loss aversion framing around the credit itself. And so we tested two different emails, and the personal tone was much more successful than the corporate tone. But again, I think the coming back to that attention is limited. I think overall we were still, maybe we maxed out at like 34% or something. So there was still a lot of money being left on the table. And, I think that's just, again, to highlight this more broadly, that is a challenge that we should keep trying to solve. There's more to be done there for sure.
Well, and I think there's the two things that jump out there. One is how much opportunity there still is in this whole space of generosity for all of us. You know, donation page converts at like 17%, which means 83% of people click donate and don't give, or, you know, 64% of people have free money to give away and don't actually distribute. So, you know, you talked about that intention gap, the $250 billion gap. It's probably much bigger because there's even more that we could do. So that's, you know, something to keep in mind, and how interesting that is. I think the other thing too for us, I mean, I call myself a charity nerd, but, you know, people who study this, I think it's good for us to understand just how the average person cares, but probably cares a lot less than we think. You know, those of us that do this work, we care a ton. We spend our lives doing this. So we project disproportionately about how much the average person, maybe cares the wrong word, how much time or attention they give it, to your point, but there's a gap there as well where, you know, people just aren't reading and clicking and thinking about this like we hope or think that they are. They just aren't.
Right. And I think the other thing is to remember is that for most people, the experience of thinking about charitable giving, that only happens when somebody asks them for money, right? So something bad happens, or your friend is running in a marathon, or, you know, there are different reasons. There's a variety of reasons, but it's often our donation is a reactionary thing. And, you know, we get used to that mental model of how charitable giving should work. And so you can be a very well-intentioned donor and still, you know, be sitting and waiting for someone to ask you for money. And a lot of the time, what we're trying to do here is actually get people to be a little more proactive, right? And a little more thoughtful and informed about where they're giving.
Yeah. And so, I think that's what's really interesting, because, you know, donor fatigue, something that everyone, not everyone, a lot of people spend a lot of time talking about, like, oh, I'm so fatigued. But then the problem is, if you do not ask, whether you're a donor advised fund or a workplace giver or a nonprofit, the ask still plays an absolutely critical role in making people think or engage with the decision to give or not give. People don't just sit at home and wake up and be like, I should really give some money. Like, there has to be some impetus for them to engage. And that's where the ask comes. So when we hear people say donor fatigue or getting asked, often I think the translation is it's a bad ask. Like, it's not contextual, it's not relevant, it's not done well. It's just like, you know, money please kind of ask. I think that's where more of that comes out. Because if we don't ask, then people will not give, for a lot of what we've seen. I don't know if that is too like crass or not, you know, aspirational enough. I'm not sure, but it does seem like that is a critical piece that we have to do.
Right. I know. You know, we entertain thoughts of like, could you just blow that all up? Is there a way to totally change it and turn it on its head and, remove that requirement in some way so that donors could fully be proactive and the, you know, every most effective charity gets all the money they need. But it's quite a big challenge.
And maybe we'll get there over time or make some progress towards there. Maybe this ties into one of the other experiments that you did around goal setting. Because that is a little bit more like, you know, how do you structure things so that people can maybe build charitable giving or charitable activities more into their, you know, everyday life? with some set markers. Can you explain kind of like the goal setting project and kind of what you found?
Yeah. So that principle, like you said, is a pretty, it's a fundamental principle, right? If you want people to be proactive and about their giving, it seems like one thing that they should do is set a budget or set some sort of, have some sort of idea of what they want to, some sort of plan set for what they want to give. And so this was a simple goal setting tool. We partnered with Bright Funds, which is a workplace giving platform. And what users did is they could set a goal. It was a percentage goal based on their income. It's a very simple, very quick process. And then after you set that goal, every time you logged into the platform, you saw feedback on how close you were to reaching that goal. So, and then there were a few emails that reminded people of you know, whether they were on track or not. So it was pretty simple goal setting tool. And what we saw is it worked really well for the people who used it. We, you know, not a ton of employees truly engaged with it. And this again goes back to this like attention challenge that I'm a little bit obsessed with right now and I really want to solve. Because if you can get people to sit down and do it, it will work, right? And they'll find it useful and it will make them more generous. But you know, we're competing with a lot of other things in your life that get in the way. But I do think, so again, though, we did see some promising results and are excited about trying to scale it up. And again, this gets to like the role of a DAF, right? A DAF can actually kind of help with that because it can be that goal setting place and can actually kind of, you can set that goal and then you can follow through and be held accountable to that goal if you're actually setting that money aside. So anyway, we do think that goal setting is really interesting and it was a promising result and are hoping to kind of increase that. And the other interesting thing there is that it does help the workplace setting can help to create this like norm of giving in a thoughtful and intentional way. So if it's something that everyone around you is using, you know, then it will continue to be the sort of like go-to way of thinking.
Yeah. And I think that's actually a huge opportunity in the world of philanthropy moving forward. Isn't so much corporate giving, right? I mean, there is corporate giving and workplace giving, you know, it's kind of like blurred lines depending on how they structure it. But, you know, that opportunity for that social norms and that those conversations to happen, I think in the context of a corporate culture is massive. There's things that you just can't do as an operator. Like you can't convene all your donors and talk about goals and match. Like it's just, it's really, really different. And that's why I love the type of research or in this study, at least is some of it's in that workplace. Cause I think that's been an undertapped, you know, underused. There's kind of like the pass the hat campaign once a year, but you know, is this really intentional? Is this really helping people drive generosity? But there's so much that we can do because it is kind of a controlled environment.
Absolutely.
On that note, I want to, we'll end on kind of testing and some of the methodology. I'd like to hear more about like, what are you doing now? So this was, you know, a couple of years ago and you've done some of that research, but like, what are you working on now? What are you excited about other than finding how to get people's attention, which is critical?
So this work, was some work we did a few years ago. And then since then, we've been building on the learnings from this initial foray into the space to now design sort of more concepts from scratch that we can actually partner and test with folks. And so we have a few insights and learnings that are really driving that. Of course, attention is limited is number one. but again, just understanding how we get in front of donors at the right time when they can really take that action. And going beyond even just giving platforms, right? So we've done a lot of work on giving platforms when people are in that discovery mode, but like, how do you get people to sit down with their families or something and start setting this norm of giving in intentionally and thoughtful ways? So that's something we're really interested in. We're also the insight around that I mentioned earlier a little bit, how giving is so reactive and emotional. So something that is a very important thing that we do not want to lose is that people give because they want to do good, right? They want to have this emotional connection and this warm glow. And that is completely valid and exciting and like a wonderful part of being human. And it's not something we want to get rid of. And so sometimes when we think about, you know, goal setting and numbers on the page, it starts to remove some of that wonderful emotional aspect of giving. Mm-hmm. And so something that we've learned sometimes the hard way, right? Sometimes by designing something that was a little bit too mathematical. Some of those early goal setting prototypes, for example, we really don't want to lose that, right? We want to make sure we're designing solutions that really preserve that emotion while still allowing donors to be intentional and informed and thoughtful.
Yeah, I think that's a great point there too, because I think a lot of, a lot of people like yourself, and I'm sure your colleagues and a lot of researchers and a lot of academics, a lot of people who create giving platforms have a certain kind of, way of looking at things. And then unintentionally, perhaps it comes out in like the work that they do. So, years ago, there was a study called Seven Faces of Philanthropy, and they tried to break up their donors into seven buckets. And the investor, the type who really looks to like maximize impact and ROI and data was like 12% of donors at the time. Mm-hmm. So the point being, whether it's 12% or 20%, the reality is not everyone is motivated by that type of thing. And so I think there's almost like a disproportionate amount of platforms and research kind of going into that, because that's who builds platforms and who does research are the analytical type, right? So we're like, why aren't you giving? It's like, well, they're nothing like you. They operate totally different. So in less of like one solution to rule them all, it's almost like, how do we let the analytical types give in the analytical way? How do we let more like, legacy dynastic type people engage their families and pass on values, and like that's also strategic, but it's different. So there's like, this has to kind of evolve. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. This is kind of like a comment. Maybe you can figure it out.
I know. Absolutely. I mean, we're looking at some ways of bringing that sort of like going back to the giving guidance or the feedback piece, like how can you make that feel more personalized and warm? And actually giving feedback is kind of cool, because when you donate, you get this kind of burst of warm glow, right? I feel really good. I'm helping someone. But then in theory, right, when you get that feedback later on that says, oh, these are the people you helped, you kind of get that again. So, so if we do that well, that can actually help make it more strengthen that emotional connection.
Yeah. And maybe this is a good test or a good link into kind of like how you test. Cause I do think that's the thing that we've struggled with a lot. A lot of our early day testing is pure acquisition, get an email, get a click, get someone to give. And our focus and the industry's focus really on acquisition has created this chronic problem of lack of retention, lack of engagement. And part of it is it's hard to collect that data. It's hard to understand, behavior over a 6-month time period, or, it's really hard to understand. So then you just default to what you can easily see. And we know conversion rates, but we don't know what happens 12 months later. So one of the interesting things about your testing and approach is trying to not just look at, one moment in time, but more of the, longitudinal impact. Can you talk more about, testing and maybe even like RCTs and philanthropy? Or what RCTs are and why they exist in philanthropy?
Yeah, I think there's a few pieces there. I mean, I think I don't think we've solved the problem of the longitudinal challenge in terms of in philanthropy of being able to track a donor over long-term time horizons. I think there are some, we're working with partners to try to do that, but it's always a challenge, right? So how do you, if you survey people, you still have kind of a biased sample, right? So there's some challenges there, but the platform is an interesting, I think, channel for that. So we are hopeful that we can find some strategies. Mm. In other work we do, it's a little bit easier to track one user really, as opposed to one behavior, if that makes sense. So I think a lot of the sort of website data collection is like a behavior and action in the moment, like you said. And what we really want to understand is like actually what is a user doing over time, as opposed to just like on their one interaction.
Right.
But to step back, so that's one piece. But then the randomized control trial, the RCT. Do you want me to define it? Is that helpful?
Yeah, please do.
Oh, yeah. Okay, great. So a randomized controlled trial, that language comes from the pharmaceutical industry, right? So, and it's because that requires like very rigorous testing, right, before we release drugs to the public. So, the theory behind it basically is if you want to test out an intervention, which is the word that we use, again, borrowing that from the pharmaceutical agency, land, but putting it here. If you want to test something on a group of people to see if it actually changed their behavior, if you just do that without without doing any sort of control, which I'll explain, what happens is you can't really tell whether or not it was your thing that changed their behavior or something else. So you know, right now, for example, if I were testing something on my website, to, you know, this is late March, Brady, and we are in the midst of a, obviously it's like
midst
really
of a pandemic.
Pandemic. Yeah. And so if I were testing something on my website right now and absent, I guess, a control, I would say, I might look back at that data and say, wow, that really didn't work. No one, if I'm in, not in a, you know, depending, I guess, where you're raising money, but for example, if you're in the environmental space right now, it's a little bit tough. So you might conclude, oh, it's not working. But actually, there's a lot more going on in the world that's influencing those numbers. And so what a randomized controlled trial does is it creates two groups of people that are statistically identical by randomizing across a large group. And so when you have that scenario, if you show one group of people your thing, apply your intervention to that one group of people, and then you see a change in behavior, you can actually say that change in behavior was due to the intervention that I designed and that they experienced. So it lets you assign causality to the situation. And then you know, okay, this thing had this impact, and then you can feel pretty certain about scaling it up or applying it in other ways. And that's really useful because then you're not going to waste money on things that don't work or sometimes like have weird backfire effects. An early prototype of our goal setting tool actually almost accidentally forced people to take it. It showed up as a splash screen on your on the website. And we were like, hey, that's fine. This will just get more people to use it. But actually, we saw this very weird backfire effect where people sort of panicked and actually closed out of the whole window and temporarily dropped donation rates. So we got rid of that immediately. But like that was really useful information, right? And that's information you might not have seen if you hadn't run a quick test like that.
Yeah. And so again, a couple things there, and we can come back to just like the power of testing. But the randomized control trial methodology, it sounds, I mean, it's great. It's great. So like, how can you actually control all those things? So for example, one of my favorite studies from last year, we took two groups of people, randomized. One group got one additional cultivation email per week for 3 months, and then they continued it on for 6 months. And the other group got the regular kind of email cadence. And that was the only change that we did to that audience. And the people that got the extra email a week got 80% increase in engagement, 42% increase in revenue. After 6 months, it was 56% increase in engagement, 42% increase in revenue. So a lot more engagement, a lot more revenue. So one of the outcomes is like cultivation is really powerful in driving revenue. But the thing that we couldn't control is all the other things that they clicked, you know, what they exactly clicked within all the emails that they received. Like how controlled does an environment, you know, need to be? Because especially when you get into digital testing, there's only so much that you can control. And the longer it goes on, the less control you actually have.
Right, right. Absolutely. Right. And in theory, if you have a group that's big enough and you've done the randomization well, both groups should be experiencing those
similar,
weird other factors, right? In theory. But there are, sometimes you have to be careful because there are weird confounding variables that can show up. And even weird, I'm trying to think, like some weird, you know, occasionally have someone who like does it like alphabetically, or they try to like split the alphabet and they're like, the top of the alphabet is my control and the bottom is a treatment. But the problem is that people's names don't actually, like there are lots of, people have different, people's names actually correlate to like different
stuff.
Cultural backgrounds so it actually is a lot more complicated. And then the other challenge I think maybe you're getting a little bit too is that you should be trying to change, in theory you should try to do as little as possible so that you can say like, oh, it was this one thing. So going back to our framing example, if we're going to frame something from a loss aversion perspective, we should really do it so well that like one email is exactly identical except for there is a slight difference in the loss aversion framing and the other email doesn't have that. Sometimes, so this is one of the things that gets, Ideas 42 is different than like an academic setting where that is, that you might get to that level of detail. We are primarily interested in impact. So we want to see that this thing worked and that we got the goals that we're looking for. And so, and in this case, it might be a little bit different. In some of our work, especially where it's like health focused, right? We don't care so much about the exact mechanisms. We leave that to our academic partners to figure that out. What we really want to see is like, did we get more adults getting the flu vaccination or something like that?
Yeah.
And so we might throw a few different like interventions into the email to test.
Yeah, that. I think that, I mean, we do the same, right? So we're not an academic research institution where we work with nonprofits to help them get lifts. And right. If you do isolate one variable, especially if it's smaller, the impact is smaller, the sample size is greater, and then it takes you more time to like get to your end destination. So, you know, we struggle with that all the time of like, what's the balance between, you know, academic rigor and also just the real world of producing results.
Absolutely.
And that's always has a balance. And it's one of the tough things when we teach, you know, A-B testing, because people, you know, read the rules, or maybe they took statistics in college or whatever it is. And they're like, what? You can't change two variables. And it's like, well,
right.
A, like you kind of can, like you can variable right. cluster things. Like if you're trying to do personal tone, this is a good example, actually. Mm-hmm. If you just change the subject line and then they open the email and then the rest of the email is corporate tone, are you really testing personal tone in the email, or are you just testing personal tone in the subject line? You know, if the sender is like CEO, you know, bigwig, are you really carrying through? So you could change who it's from, the subject line and the tone of the email, three different variables, but along one hypothesis of the more personal approach. So there are ways to do, you know, multiple changes with a guiding hypothesis as well. Right. So again, this is where like the nerd academic side, you know, rubber meets the road and how to actually do that.
Right.
So all that to say, the power of RCTs, I think, is still underused. You know, like a lot of the tests that we do and other people doesn't look at more of the downstream. This is where premiums, like if we give you something, you can get more giving, but 6 months down the road, it typically decreases the likelihood of their giving, the happiness of their giving. So if we're not tracking those things, then we could be hurting ourselves, actually, if we're not tracking those things. So if someone's maybe interested in like, I would like to do more longitudinal testing or more like RCT style. You mentioned a couple things like, you know, truly randomizing, don't just split a list based on the alphabet or something like that. What would be some other like tips or best practices when people are considering it?
Yeah, I would. So not to plug our website too much, but we actually do have, the Ideas for AC website has a paid, we actually have an A-B testing tool because it is so hard to get right. That can help guide people through it. Also, I've directed, I guess in general, what I end up telling people to do is go find a really simple guide online to walk you through it, because even the analysis itself can be a little bit confusing. But in general, I think you've hit the big things, right? So like making sure that you're setting up the sort of that you have the ability to set up that randomized structure. So one of the challenges, right, you can make sure that someone coming to your website, when they click on a link, that you're actually able to like randomize them to different pages. And there are a lot of tools nowadays that exist to help that. But I mean, I think maybe overall, it's just like remembering that this is okay to test things and that it's like okay to fail. Like you actually want one thing to fail, right? You want to know that one is better than the other. And so I think also just like giving yourself the ability to say like, you know what? I'm not going to know. I can't figure out which tone is going to work right in the situation. I can think it to death and I can go look at a million academic papers, but you're not going to quite know until you actually just test it.
Yeah, no, that's a great point too. But also why an actual testing methodology really helps, because failure isn't the problem. If you fail and don't learn, that is a huge problem.
Right.
Right. So if you don't say, this is what we're trying to learn and here's, you know, what the hypothesis actually is. And that's one of the biggest things that actually we've seen from people who, I'm using air quotes, test, is not actually like a hypothesis formulation. So like you try something and then you see the result and then you kind of reverse engineer, you know, it worked or didn't work. And it's like, well, maybe you got the lift that you wanted, but did you learn, you know, what you really needed? And that's the thing that's so critical about the methodology. So anyways, we'll share your link, your A-B testing tool. With people if they're looking to do more of that. So anyways, we could go on and on about testing and things like that. So thanks for sharing. I appreciate you taking time to share more about, you know, the research and the really cool work that you guys are doing. Where can people find out more about you and your work?
Yeah, so ideas42.org, ideas42, just like the Hitchhiker's Guide for the Galaxy, number answer to the universe. If you go there, we have a page devoted to our charitable giving work. That's where you can find the A-B testing link. But check out our giving page. The other thing is that we're always looking for partners and people to talk to about this stuff. We are a nonprofit, and then like you saw from our examples, we work with workplace giving platforms and charity aggregators and payment platforms, all sorts of different DAFs, et cetera. We work with partners a lot to actually make our work happen. So we are always happy to chat about our work.
Awesome. Well, thanks again for the work that you do and for taking some time to come in and share about some of the work that you're doing. So thank you.
Great. Thank you, Brady.
Hi again, this is Brady, and I just wanted to say thank you so much for listening to the podcast. I hope you enjoyed that episode. If you'd like to listen to all future episodes or maybe go back and listen to some of our past episodes, you can do so by going to generosityfreakshow.com, or you can search The Generosity Freak Show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, pretty much wherever you listen to your pods. And if you have any questions or a suggested guest, or maybe you yourself would like to come on the show, we'd love to hear from you. You can contact us at podcast@nextafter.com. That's podcast@nextafter.com. And if you want to find out more about this vision to unleash the most generous generation in the history of the world and what we're doing at NextAfter in terms of research, resources, and training, you can find out more at nextafter.com. That's nextafter.com. Thank you very much for listening. And finally, I have to say thank you to Nathan Hill, our producer and mixologist. This would not be possible without him. So thank you, Nathan. And thank you once again for listening.